White, Appellant's Counsel, David L. Pelt, Justin S. Rabbit, David S. Gillespie, Appellee's Counsel.
May it please the Court. My name is Justin Sheldon. I am the attorney representing the appellant Nancy Gillian, who is here with us today. There are two assignments of error before the Court today. The first is that the trial court erred in refusing to set aside a verdict of $0 in light of uncontradicted and uncontroverted evidence of damages. In fact, and the second assignment of error is that the court erred in refusing to allow Ms. Gillian to testify that the appellee here, after crashing into her, got out of his car, runs up to her, says abusive language, including calling her a black bitch. So I'm going to address the first issue here. The situation is before the court here is that Ms. Gilliam was rear-ended. She was taken from the scene of the accident, as she testified and is in the record. She was taken from the scene of the accident to an emergency room where she was diagnosed.
Is there any damage to the car?
There was very minor damage to the car. I believe there was she was able to identify a scratch in the car. It was minor impact to the vehicle.
So a scratch is the damage to the car?
I believe so. It was a bumper-to-bumper impact at a relatively low speed.
And she was diagnosed as having a strain as opposed to a sprain?
That's correct, Your Honor. A back strain, which the defendant's expert, Dr. Whipple, agreed to and acknowledged that injury, the strain, would cause pain for up to 6 weeks.
But he was relying on her report.
He was relying on the medical records as well that were before him. So
that was all based on her report.
Absolutely, Your Honor, but it's still uncontradicted evidence at this point. The evidence is she testified to that. He reviewed those records and the records of a doctor that treated her and diagnosed her based on not only what she said, but his observations of what was said and done at that trial.
Why couldn't a jury say, you know, there's something here. She's probably entitled to something to make sure her strain is not more serious, but she's asking for $10,000 in specials. And she has the burden of segregating the exaggerated hyperbolic damages from the legit damages. And if a jury can't, by a preponderance, 51% certitude, know where to draw the line in that 10K number for specials, then it's just a burden of proof issue. In other words, it's the price of exaggerating.
I would disagree with that because if we're going to accept, which I won't hear, but if we're going to accept that there is exaggeration here and that...
Normally, you don't need $10,000 to take care of a strain on your neck as opposed to a sprain when you go to work the next day.
I acknowledge that, Your Honor. However, she was also diagnosed by a subsequent doctor with a torn rotator cuff, and she was treated for that, and that was also part of this trial. So the damages, and that part of the damages was controverted. There was dispute over whether or not that injury was related.
So the jury could have completely carved off the rotator cuff, and that takes me right back to my first question. You got $10,000, a portion of that is completely carved off, a portion of that is related to a strain, the portion that's left appears, hypothetically speaking, to a fact finder to be exaggerated, and they don't know how much is the exaggeration part, they don't know how much is the legit part, so the party with the burden of proof loses.
If they aren't able to identify what is legitimate or is not legitimate, but if they are able to say there is legitimate damage here, a zero verdict is contrary to the uncontradicted evidence.
And well, no, they can't pick a number out of the hat. They've got to have a number from the plaintiff. The plaintiff's got to establish the extent of the legitimate damages, not simply that I have legitimate damages. Somewhere in this 10K, it's there.
And they can only do that through their own testimony, the testimony of expert witnesses, their own, and the defendants. And here, in this situation, that was done. On opening statement, defense counsel actually identified the first four elements of the damages in this damages statement that's listed here are related to the initial treatment. That's uncontradicted evidence. That is what the evidence was, that she was taken by ambulance to the emergency room, she was treated, and then she was told to follow a doctor, and she did.
But reasonably necessary is the test for whether or not the number should actually be awarded. Obviously, it's related. She didn't go for some other proffer. And the last question I'll ask you on this subject before I let you go is, there's essentially an instruction by the trial judge at the time of the verdict. When you put that on the other side of the coin, it's normally called law of the case. And one cannot challenge the sufficiency of the evidence to give an instruction unless there was an objection to it. Why isn't that, why doesn't that cut right through the issue?
Are you referring to the instruction where you're the jury, you have to, liability has been admitted, you are here to determine damages, if any, and you can't allow, is that the instruction that you're referring to? I believe that's a separate issue from what is on appeal here. That is an issue of what is the law of the case. The law of the case is, yes, you have to determine what the damages are, if any, based on the facts before you. Still, based on the facts before you is an inherent element of that. The jury is then charged with, based on those facts, to go back and make a determination on what damages the defendant incurred here. The damages are, at the very minimum, the uncontroverted damages that are before the jury, which are the initial treatment.
Were those special damages put into evidence, the specific costs?
Yes, Your Honor, they were. Okay. And they were acknowledged by Dr. Whipple, who was a defense expert, who, look at the record, is page 215. He's asked specifically, okay, doctor, in reviewing the medical records that you were provided and the x-rays and the MRIs, did you reach a conclusion with regard to what injuries the plaintiff may have, in fact, suffered as a result of this accident? He says, yes, I did. Then he goes, the injuries that she sustained in the accident, according to all of the evidence that leads to my impression, is that she had a muscular strain injury to her neck and a muscular strain injury to her low back. He goes on to say he has no opinion on how long that muscle strain would take, but that it would be symptomatic for, could be symptomatic for up to 6 weeks. That is an admission by that part, by the defendant here, that she was injured and that she was injured to that extent for that period of time, for up to that period of time. But there is uncontradicted evidence that she was hurt, that she reasonably treated for that injury, because there was no evidence to the contrary that it wasn't, that the treatment that she received wasn't reasonable for that very small, specific initial treatment. Moving on to the issue of prohibiting the defendant of speaking, of testifying that immediately after the crash, the defendant came up and said some very unpleasant things to her, including calling her a black bitch.
I'm sorry, before I let you get on to that, let me go back to the zero question.
Yes, Your Honor.
At 165 and 166, if I'm reading this correctly, the judge is talking to the jury, instructing them on the verdict form, and he says, in order to preclude any misunderstanding of the verdict, when the foreperson completes the verdict form, you may and are requested to please write in the dollar amount that you decide to award, and that is a specific number. That number can be zero. Well, that's an instruction of the court to a jury, and there's no objection. Now, the argument is essentially a sufficiency argument on the flip side. We normally get the sufficiency on the other side of these cases, but it's essentially a sufficiency argument. No rational jury could have found zero. Well, they were instructed that they could find zero, and there's no objection. So that's law of the case, that a rational jury under this fact pattern could find zero.
I will answer it this way, Your Honor. In failing to object to the judge's discussion there, what is waived is the ability now to raise an error on that the judge committed error by saying that. It doesn't alleviate the jury.
Suppose the judge had said, you can't put in zero. I hold that there's got to be an award of damages of some kind. Defense says nothing. No objection. And then they put in a gazillion dollars. And then the defense appeals to us saying, as a matter of law, the evidence is insufficient to show anything other than zero. What would probably happen is the court would say, well, you should have objected to the instruction that said that zero was not allowed.
I guess the question I have for you is, what constitutes a jury instruction? Because my understanding of what was said at this particular time was not an instruction. This didn't go back to the jury, did it?
It did not, Your Honor. And that was going to be my next point. This is not a jury instruction. This, I believe, is the judge merely saying, this is the verdict form, this is how you fill out a verdict form.
He's merely instructing the jury on the very verdict form that's on appeal to us. That's not a jury instruction.
I do not believe that it's not a jury instruction. It's not titled as a jury instruction. It wasn't given that way. And again,
gratuitous comments by the court.
I'm sorry?
Gratuitous comments by the court.
I believe so.
Or explanatory comments, because he's talking about writing a number out like you do on a check, I think is what he said. It's like, it could be zero, it could be a number other than zero. The thing is, write it out.
I believe that is correct. And I believe, even so, that doesn't relieve the jury of its duty of finding facts. And whenever you have uncontroverted evidence of damages, the law is that becomes a fixed constituent part of the verdict. And so the jury cannot merely say, well, even though all of this evidence is here, there's nothing to the contrary, we're going to give zero. We're going to fine for her and give zero.
Well, does it relieve you of the duty to object?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Well, I mean, nobody objected to that statement, whether we call it a jury instruction, a gratuitous comment, but the judge made it to the jury.
That's correct.
So the fact that you didn't object,
I agree. That deprives me at this point of arguing that the judge erred in giving that instruction. Or not giving that instruction, but saying that. I can't say the judge committed error here by
But unobjected to instructions become law of the case. It's not that the jury can do whatever they want to do. It's just that it's a waiver of the opportunity to challenge them doing something wrong.
Which goes back to whether or not it's an instruction. Because the judge also says after this, he's explaining the jury form. He says, I don't care what he says. The court is not concerned about what the number is. What I'm concerned about is that you write it out rather than you just take a pen and ink to this thing, because your handwriting may create more issues than it solves. So whoever's your foreperson, just write out the amount that you decide to the ward after you deliberate. And then he talks about basically writing it out like you do a check. So I guess it goes back to whether or not that's an instruction, whether somebody would, standing there as a lawyer, would think it was an instruction as opposed to, I'm just explaining how you fill out this form.
I agree completely, Ron. I see that my time is running down. I just want to address the second issue here, and that is our argument here is that the law should be that when somebody is injured, and then the person that injures them comes up and says something to them that is incredibly offensive and creates an additional mental emotional pain, that should be something that is relevant for the jury to consider. I don't believe that it should be or is required to become a separate cause of action, but it's certainly relevant to the experience that Ms. Gilliam had in this crash, and I think that it was relevant and it was proper for the jury to hear that.
It affected her neck strain, what this man said to her?
The fact that she was crashed into. It's not merely that she had a neck strain. It's somebody crashes into her, gets out of her car.
Well, the crash was over when he made his remark, so the automobile claim had come and gone in terms of causation at that point.
I agree, but this is still a continuous. It's a continuous action that it's a continuous. It's a continuous action. It's part of the same transaction. Or
if he calls her the next day, or a week later, or before the trial, would that relate back also?
It would relate. I believe it would be a different situation. This is, she's in one mental state, and she's going to be at that point weakened in that state because she's emotional.
Counsel, I note that you said the law should be. Do you have any cases that would support your theory that this evidence should have come in?
I do not, Your Honor. Not in Virginia. It's strictly a petition that we understand differently now than we have in the past what mental suffering is, the court has taken steps away from having to have a physical, if we're having an emotional, an intentional infliction of emotional stress, or a negligent infliction of emotional stress rather, claim, having to have a physical manifestation of that, and we know now from science and what's going on that that is different, and I believe that this is a
That's good, too. We have a tort for this very thing, and the tort was not asserted.
I agree, because I don't think that this rose to the level of that tort. I believe that it was part of the same transaction occurrence and should have been admitted.
Well, do you think the mental anguish has to result from the negligence that caused the collision?
I think generally it does, but if there is an immediate action that aggravates that mental anguish, that is admissible. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much.
Please support. My name is David Houck, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee. The appellant argues that the trial court erred in holding the jury verdict. And as has been explained here today earlier, the jury verdict is afforded the utmost deference under Virginia law. The verdict would not be set aside unless there are two factors. One is that it is plainly wrong, or it is contrary to the evidence. With regard to the question of plainly wrong, we get to your Honor's question about the jury verdict, or the jury instructions, excuse me. When the jury instructions were discussed with the court, we pointed to the incident where the judge indicated the zero verdict, and put a zero in if you want. But prior to that, he'd given instruction number 5 that says that the defendant has admitted that he is liable for any injury the plaintiff received in the accident. Therefore, the only issue you have is to decide the amount of damages, if any. So there was a specific instruction to talk to if any or zero being an appropriate amount. So I think it is included in the instructions, and that does then become the law of the case. And once that becomes the law of the case, when you're evaluating whether or not there is a reason to overturn the jury's verdict, it is not plainly wrong. They follow the law that they were given.
The objection should have been, no, Your Honor, I object respectfully. It can't be if any.
Yes,
it's got to be some. So please, amend your instruction.
Yes, sir, Judge. Your Honor, I think that it was incumbent upon the plaintiff or their attorney at that point in time to make it clear that they did not believe a zero verdict was appropriate, even to the extent if they thought they had the evidence, they should have directed a verdict in the amount of the specials they thought had been conceded. Now, I would have objected and said that I'm not conceding that because I don't think that's what my evidence showed. But I do think that it was incumbent upon them to do that. And once they do that, that does become the law of the case, and they're bound by it. And this court, unfortunately, is bound by it, too, because if any, is now an appropriate verdict. So the jury did not do wrong. Then the question I think they can only then go back to is, well, then, was there evidence, is it contrary to the evidence that was presented at trial? And in that regard, this was a soft tissue case where there were two components of the damages. Basically, there was a soft tissue sprain or strain that occurred, and she complained of immediately after the accident. And then there was a more serious injury to her shoulder that was also as part of their damages, and it resulted in a surgery being done, and it was a major portion of the specials that they were claiming. In that regard, So you kind of break it into two parts of the damages. The first is that with regard to the soft tissue, there was no objective finding of any injury as a result of this accident. The plaintiff was the only person called to testify with regard to those injuries, and in fact, any doctor who saw her in the first 8 months was not called upon to testify. So all you had was her statement with regard to whether
well,
or not...
Well, that's not all you have. You have your expert who testifies that there was a muscle strain that would have taken up to 6 weeks to heal. So that's not all that you have.
Well, I think what we have, though, is if you remember that there's two components to the damages. There's the soft tissue and the shoulder.
Taking out the shoulder altogether.
Yeah, Dr. Whipple primarily was there for the purpose of evaluating whether or not the surgery or the shoulder injury or that surgery would be related.
He may have been there primarily to do that, counsel, but he specifically testified that there was a soft tissue. I don't know if he said strain or sprain. I'll get there in a minute. But he also said it would have taken it up to 6 weeks to heal. Is that not his testimony?
I think it's a little bit different than that. I asked him the question on page 215 of JA.
215, line 17 and 18, the injury that she sustained in the accident, according to all of the evidence that leads to my impression, is that she had a muscular strain injury to her neck, a muscular strain injury to her low back.
I think what he was asked was, are what injuries may she have received as a result of that? And he says, my review of the evidence, and this was a peer review, not an IME, so he never talked to the plaintiff. All he did was review medical records, and then he reviewed the deposition transcript of the plaintiff, where in both those records she makes complaints of this injury. Dr. Whipple said based upon those, he finds that his impression was she may have had those injuries.
No, he said, the injuries that she sustained in the accident, according to all of the evidence that leads to my impression, is that she had a muscular strain injury to her neck and back, strain injury to her low back.
The evidence that he had before him, though, necessarily required him to not evaluate the veracity of the plaintiff or the person making the complaints. He wasn't asked to do that. That's not a part of what he could do. And, in fact, he didn't hear the testimony that the plaintiff gave at the trial herself. So he never spoke as to the veracity. So if he looked in the records and she made the complaint, then he said that was what his impression of an injury that she may have received. But that doesn't mean we're conceding that that was the injury. It goes back to the fact that it's their burden of proof to show that, in fact, that she did receive the injury. And once that happens, her veracity comes into issue. And there are a number of problems with regard to her veracity. She described the impact of the automobiles as being a boom. She described it as being pushing her forward, and it was much more dramatic than perhaps the picture showed. But she wasn't shown any pictures on the direct examination. She was just describing it. She then went on to indicate that she had these problems, but she did not miss any days of work.
Can I take you back to the defense expert? You know, a jury or a trial judge in a bench trial is hearing the defense expert say just what was read to us, which he clearly said. They don't have to believe that. He is not an IME. He's just reporting what someone else has put down somewhere, which is all 100% taken from her personal report. And there's no real number that's associated with the strain. The meds don't clearly identify, here's what you would do if you just had a very mild, extremely mild, almost imperceptible strain with zero bruising, zero inflammation. So the question is not sufficiency on the other side of the coin. The question is, could a rational person hear that and go, well, who has the burden of proof? The plaintiff does. Okay, I'm not persuaded by our 51% certitude of a dollar number associated with this repetition of hearsay by the defense doctor.
I think that's correct. And I think that the instruction that they're given with regard to expert testimony requires them to look at the underlying basis for his testimony, which they can accept or reject. The instructions that they're given, the first instruction they're given, says you are the judges of the...
You would get hosed if they put a number on it, and then it was pointed out that your own witness said this. Then that would hose you. You would lose the sufficiency argument, but you won the point with the fact finder.
Yes.
That's the big difference here.
Yes.
Do you agree there was a scratch to the car?
Yes. The problem sometimes is that when the trial is going on in real time and the plaintiff gets to go on first and is only asked certain questions from their attorney, an impression is laid with the jury with regard to whatever it is she says. And then on cross-examination, I get to point out whatever discrepancies I think there are between what she says and maybe what the facts are. And I think when a plaintiff says it's a boom and it's this and again jerk me forward, and then I show them a picture, I think that undermines their credibility more severely than if she would have acknowledged that that was the picture to begin with. And when that happens, I think plaintiffs, like lawyers in trials, are put on a different pedestal with the jury. You have to prove your veracity, you have to prove your honesty. I think you can't overstep, and I think that's what I try to do as a lawyer, and I think plaintiffs need to do in order to be believed. In this instance, I think there were instances where she overstepped, and the jury was surprised by that because it wasn't the story they were initially told. And I think that affected her credibility. And once it affects her credibility, then I think she can't recover on a soft tissue injury where necessarily you have to believe she's telling the truth that this car with a scratch caused these injuries that she got tens of thousands of dollars of treatment for. And I think that's part of the problem. Another part of the problem was...
And part of what that gets at, if there was a scratch as opposed to nothing, then there had to be at least sufficient force to cause that. And wouldn't she get at least damages for the scratch?
Well, she could get property damages for the scratch, but I think the jury would have to believe...
But that's still not a zero number.
I'm sorry.
That's still not a zero number, right?
But she didn't sue for property.
Yeah.
And if she had, perhaps they would have reimbursed her for a bump. I don't know that. But in this instance, I think the veracity is important. You know, a number of instances during her testimony where I think the veracity was questioned. This was a minimal impact, and she testified that she had severe injuries related to that or disabilities, but she didn't miss a day from work. She also testified to the jury that she had trouble. It was a right shoulder problem. She had trouble reaching the cigarettes and the lottery tickets that she had to dispense during the course of the day at work. But on cross-examination, she acknowledged she was left-handed. And I think, again, that leaves an impression with the jury that she's not being forthright with them, which goes to her credibility, which again goes back to the fact that not only would the jury have to believe her, they could also say, we don't think Dr. Whipple had enough information, but we believe him at least on that issue. So I think it all comes back to the fact that it's a credibility question, and I don't think they carried their burden. I think from my perspective, since the verdict was returned in favor of my client, then I think all I have to show is that there was some evidence that to support what the jury was directed they could do, which is find a zero verdict. And I think the record is replete with in the discrepancies between the evidence as in the form of pictures and some of the complaints that she may not be consistent with what the testimony did either through deposition or court trial. So I think for those reasons, I don't think that they carried their burden, and I don't think that the jury's verdict was wrong or that the judge was wrong in not upholding the verdict. With regard to the situation with the inflammatory comment, nobody disagrees that it's an inflammatory comment. It should not be said. It smacks in the face of disability, which we were talking about earlier, and it's not appropriate at all. But is it compensable? And that's the question here. The first problem that the plaintiff has in this regard is that this was actually brought up in motion in limine. It was not during the course of trial we tried to introduce it. But as you know, as a trial judge, often lawyers will say, hey, we see this problem coming. We want to bring it to the court's attention. And more often than not, the court will say, we'll get to that when we get to it. I understand what the issue is, but you know, we'll address it when it gets there. In this instance, the court said he believed that only mental anguish caused by the crash is relevant to the issue of damages suffered by the plaintiff, and even if relevant, such relevance would be outweighed by the prejudicial effect. He said that he ruled that the plaintiff would have to ask permission to seek to introduce that inflammatory statement. But when we get then into the trial, it's never asked. He never requests permission to go there. So I'm not sure he presented it to the court or preserved it in that regard. Beyond that, as I think you have indicated, it's not the law in Virginia. In Virginia, in the weird trial, they were trying to argue that the general damages instruction, where they talk about mental anxiety or mental anguish, he tried to argue that was what he was including with his statement. And that clearly is not what the law is in Virginia. Bruce versus Madden states that the mental anguish has to be directly related to the physical injury. And in fact, that you don't even have to prove mental anguish. The law in Virginia is if you suffer a physical injury, it's presumed you probably had some mental anguish for that. So if the plaintiff forgets to say mental anguish, he still gets to include it in the damage instruction. That's okay. But to create a new cause of action that does not have to be pled and can be added, and does not have to have a separate level of proof that is required with the intentional infliction or negligent infliction of emotional distress, is well beyond what we have here in Virginia. And it would open, I think, the courts to every plaintiff potentially making allegations with regard to something that was done that inflamed or incensed or they were sensitive to. And I think that opens a door that doesn't need to be opened because, frankly, think Virginia does have good law with regard to the damages that are compensable in Virginia if you can prove them to the jury, which unfortunately they did not for them. Unfortunately, they did not do that in their case. So for those reasons, we believe the court acted properly in not including it. It's clearly an inflammatory statement. It clearly had no protection value under the law, had no probative value under the law as it is in Virginia at the time the judge made this ruling, so I think it was appropriate to exclude. So for those reasons, we believe that the jury verdict should be upheld, and we believe that the judge otherwise acted appropriately in what he did. I would also just comment very briefly that Judge Robbins did see all the witnesses. He had a chance to comment himself. If he thought zero wasn't the right, he didn't have to say that. He did not have any problem at all in upholding the jury's verdict that as it was given that day. So I think all in all, it was appropriate as to what he did.
That's a good point. Did the trial judge ever in the motion to reconsider say, no, you all misunderstood me when I said you could put zero in?
No. I think...
That's fine.
Did you ever ask him that?
Well, how would you ask that? I think it's difficult as a money worker to go back and look at your trial. You need to go back and see what you said or what was on there. But you do. And I think in the heat of the moment of the trial, I don't think plaintiff's counsel honestly didn't object because he thought it was objectionable. I thought at that moment in the trial, it was clear all the issues were on the table. His client hadn't done as well as he thought. There was a credibility issue. I think it was all before the court, and that's why he didn't object to the if any. He thought he was going to win on the if any, and he thought it was going to be a given that he would give Whipple's testimony to go his way. But that's not the way it fell out. But I think in the moment, he was thinking, okay, it's all on the table, and I'm going to win. And that may be why he didn't object to it. But I do think, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Do you have anything you'd like to add in the 7 seconds you have remaining?
No, you're
all right. The court will be adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
All rise.